Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, world. It's me, Dennis, and I get a chance to talk with Peter Haas today. Peter, do you prefer Peter or Pete?
I go by Peter.
All right, good. That helps me out. Peter, when you, one of the things that interests me, one of the many, many things that interests me is that we are in a, we're in an emergent culture right now where we're moving. I'm not even sure whether or not whatever we termed as AI has actually already woken up, already happened. Machines are learning from one another and learning by themselves. And when would we know? And I, so as an outsider, I have all of these wonders and thoughts, and I have to tell you, I'm wired optimistic. So I have a belief that there is going to be some, but I also have read your work and listened to your work on your 2017 TED Talk. And the first thing I want to start with, and I encourage anyone to go back and look at that TED Talk, and it will be linked on the page. What did the Peter in 2020 know now that the Peter in 2017 didn't know in three long years?
I feel like what Peter in 2017 did not know is just how fast things would progress and that concepts that were really just research in 2017 would start to be deployed in mass market by 2020. That really you'd start to see AI have an impact on culture from everything from facial recognition to deep fakes, and really the progression of the use of AI in decision making would only increase, and that we wouldn't have this big policy backlash against it to try to slow things down, but that the speed would just keep on ramping up.
There is, I mean, when you talk about that, the only way we're going to approach this is a way of regulation and standardization and understanding of what the biases, because you, could you talk a little bit about the biases that we're putting into AI and how are we dealing with that? Are we making any progress in that and recognition of that?
So I think it's important to understand for your audience that right now AI is not intelligence in the way that we think of human intelligence. It's
right.
Very narrow in its decision-making capabilities. And because of this, it's not very robust. So it lacks the contextual awareness that your average person would have, that's been built up over a lifetime of experience understanding the way the world works and how things interact.
Exactly.
And basically, because of this, it can make some really bad decisions when confronted with data that is potentially outside of a standardized curve. So AI is very good at predicting trends and trying to figure out what the average response is. But it's not very good at dealing with the edge cases. So if you have a situation that falls in that outlier experience, you can easily confuse the AI and make it make a bad decision. And to give an example of this, in my talk, I talk about criminal recidivism scoring, I think for now I'll do a more straightforward example, which is just character recognition, number recognition. There are researchers that fooled a Tesla vehicle into believing the speed limit in a certain test track was 85 miles an hour just by adding a little bit of tape to a 35 mile an hour speed limit sign. Now, any human who would see that sign would understand, oh, that's a 35 mile an hour sign with a little bit of tape on it. But for the AI system, it pushed that threshold of probability into, oh, this is probably 85 miles an hour. I should go 85 miles an hour. And there's no spot checking that. And there's no contextual awareness that humans could put tape on a sign. So I think that the big movement in AI right now is to build AI for explainability and to build AI for that contextual awareness. To try to make AI systems that can be a little bit more robust than these narrow AI systems that we have currently.
So that's where the research is going in, and we're getting just a huge amount all over the world right now, a huge amount of work that's happening in China, that's happening in Korea, Japan, India. Are there any coordinations? You were talking about because the thing that I'm interested in is I was working with and reading about AI is that has the genie gotten out of the bottle? Is there any way to get standards that we could use to, not to govern AI, I don't mean to govern AI, but I mean to understand it, like, you know, we have the atom bomb and that's out. What is happening right now with AI as far as you can see it?
So I feel like the question of standards is one that is very reminiscent of the question of cybersecurity in the early internet. When you look at the early internet, we didn't have any cybersecurity. I mean, everything was unencrypted. Everything was very easy to hack. Like, and what has evolved is companies have realized that we need to actually control this environment, because instead of being a trusting environment like the researchers are used to, it's an adversarial environment. And so they put in place different standards for things like SSL or HTTPS or TLS. And basically they created frameworks for creating a more secure internet. And those frameworks are definitely not 100% reliable currently. I mean, we definitely still have a lot of problems with cybersecurity, but we're way better than we were in, say, 1994 or 1993.
Right.
So I think the same type of thing is going to happen with AI, in that we're going to realize that we've got different competing frameworks. We've got different solutions that are out there that are open source, that are being adopted with different regularity. And what's going to happen, I think, is that you're going to have a network effect where as large numbers of people adopt a certain standard, that becomes the de facto standard that people work on improving. To the question of, do we have any general policy around AI? I don't think that you should regulate artificial intelligence per se. I think you should regulate the use of artificial intelligence in specific domains. Okay? So you shouldn't put out a blanket rule around, I'm going to regulate AI. You should say, I'm going to regulate AI in pharmaceutical drug discovery in this class of drugs.
Okay?
And then figure out what those regulations should be. So things like in criminal recidivism scoring, I feel like there should be regulation around the ability for a person to have a human review the case.
Yeah.
Okay. So if a human doesn't agree with the AI score that they've got and they feel like that was unfair, they should be able to request a human review.
Now, they do that in airplane. They do that in airplane cockpits.
Exactly. So I mean, stuff like this is the type of regulation that I was trying to advocate for in my TEDx talk.
Right.
And I really think that with the explainable AI movement and the movement towards AI that can start to tell you why it made a decision, that's going to give us a framework for controlling the development of AI. And it's going to give us a framework for dealing with things like the fear of superintelligence and runaway AI.
Absolutely.
And AI that learns on its own.
Right. And would it have any interest in telling you a lie?
So right now we're so far from that's just science fiction.
That's what I'm asking. I'm really asking for that line and where that is. I really need you to do that. Go ahead.
In terms of AI and planning, even though we can do really well in relatively narrow domains like games of Go or games of chess, what I would be ecstatic to see is if somebody could develop a planning algorithm that has the capabilities of a squirrel in terms of advanced planning.
Nice.
Like a squirrel can go out there and can anticipate that the winter is coming and store nuts for the winter. And AI can't even begin to get towards that behavioral endpoint. Like right now, AIs they're almost like people who have constant amnesia.
Yeah.
The systems that we have now with self-driving trucks are constantly taking in new information and reacting in real time to the new information. But in terms of memory and historical perspective, they don't have any of that. They're logging data, sure, but they're not referencing that log data to make new decisions.
Yeah. Okay.
But I think it is a worthwhile discussion to anticipate where technology is going. And I think people like Nick Bostrom and Max Tegmark, who are trying to raise the awareness around superintelligence, are doing a good job in trying to get us to think forward maybe 50 years, maybe 100 years. And so where does this technology go, and how do we integrate it into our society?
Got it. And all right, so with that, all right, so now let's bring us back to 2020 and now, and not just the applications of this, but I want to go back a little bit further. One of the things that so moved me was your work with in Haiti. And your work in really just figuring out that if the buildings, the same materials, the same cost were built differently, the survivability between Haiti and a much higher magnitude earthquake in Chile saved so many lives, and just with the difference in that. And so that gets into the human, getting into the changing the human at that level of stepping up and changing. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So I used to work in international development and in disaster response. And one of the situations I responded to was the 2010 Haiti earthquake. And in that response, we did trainings for masons in a technique from Chile called confined masonry.
Right.
And that technique basically created stronger structures by tying the support columns into the walls. So instead of having the walls fail and then the support columns stand alone and then they torsion and collapse, you would have a more robust structure that tied the walls into the columns. And I think that what that indicates to me, mm-hmm. and in that training, we trained a lot of people. We trained over 4,000 people, and I saw a lot of people who were doing things in a very cost-cutting way, because they'd grown up learning how to do things in a cost-cutting way. And I think that ultimately, what this gets down to when you think about the human aspect of this behavior is humans are generally looking for shortcuts. Humans are often looking for the easier way out. And the way this applies to AI is that humans could be considered in some ways intellectually lazy. Like we're trying to reduce our cognitive burden. And this is just a natural thing. If you can Google something versus having a computer in your head, you're going to Google it. Or use a calculator. Like taking off that cognitive burden is a natural desire for humans to undertake. So if we can defer decisions to an AI system and we can say, okay, well, you make the decision. I don't have to worry about this. I'll trust your decision because you're doing it mathematically. Not to anthropomorphize the AI, but I'll anthropomorphize the AI for a second.
We're gonna get there. We're gonna get there, but continue.
Yeah. So that level of reduction of cognitive load becomes a crutch for humanity.
Yes.
And I worry that as we see the wider and wider deployment of these systems, just like you've seen people's math skills go down over the past 50 years, 60 years. I mean, I was good at math. I can't do the types of calculations in my head that people would do in the 1950s or 1940s before computers.
The definition of a computer was a human being. Yeah.
Exactly. So a computer used to be a job that a person would have.
It was a person. They were named computers.
Computers, yeah, exactly. So I feel like we have to be careful of how much we trust these AI systems and what situations we trust them in to make decisions. And again, because of that lack of context, it's really important to just have some awareness that occasionally you need to second guess that system. And occasionally you need to spot check it and make sure it's making good decisions.
How do you think as we're beginning to explore this field of human consciousness and also the field of, I am going to use the C word in when we're talking about this, so you're going to really have to reel me in on this thing and anthropomorphizing AI. But anyhow, but as we talk about this, how would I keep that muscle fresh, if I weren't using it this way, how would I use it? I mean, let's assume that, trying to find the shortcut is actually a feature and not a bug, that it actually helps us to be able to find and build things. But then I still need to, in some way, keep that muscle strong, keep that ability to critical think and to think ahead strong. What do you think we could, how could I use that and go to that gym, that part of the gym, even though I'm not using it to calculate some kind of a nonlinear function?
So let's say we take a specific example of the use of AI. So let's use the example of AI in HR decision making.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, if I were an HR professional, even though I have the AI system screening resumes for me, I would carve out time in my day to take a random assortment of resumes and review them and compare the scores that the AI gave the resume to what I would score that person at and how I would judge that person. Because if we just let the AI be the gatekeeper and we never question the decisions it's making, we're going to end up in a society that's very much molded by the algorithm. And that's molded by the algorithm is not necessarily the society we want. I mean, you see this with Facebook and the polarization of society in general. Like, Facebook will feed you what you want, or YouTube will feed you what you want.
Yeah.
If you want to do a great experiment, go through something like Tor or VPN, something that'll change your IP address. And then take a fresh computer, fresh browser, no cookies, no history, and then choose a direction on YouTube. Like, search for something and choose a direction on YouTube. Either you're going to go to the right or the left. And then just click on the recommended videos for 10 times. And either way you go, within like 10 clicks, you're going to get hyper-polarized videos showing
up. Wow.
You're going to be way out of the center. And I think that what the algorithm is trying to do there is it's trying to generate clicks. It's trying to to reward you for going down things that have higher and higher clicks. And the things that are the biggest clickbait are also the most polarizing. So I think that pausing to spot check what is the algorithm feeding us and what is the ultimate goal of the organization we're working with or our individual searches on the internet, and is what the algorithm is feeding us in line with that goal, or is it even too far in line with that goal and pushing us into a polarized situation where we're only clicking on certain political ideologies, or we're only hiring people who have like a master's degree in computer science because the algorithm is weeding out the guy who went to community college who happens to be a genius. And, the reason why I think the guy who went to community college who happens to be a genius is important is if you look at the history of companies, some of the greatest companies, some of their key employees did not have traditional resumes.
Yes.
So Apple, the first Macintosh computer, one of the guys who was instrumental in making the first Macintosh went to Santa Clara Community College, did some electronics as a hobby, and was repairing the Apple IIe. And he was in the Apple IIe repair department. And he got pulled over to the McIntosh group, and he ended up being one – I'm blanking on his name right now, but he ended up being one of the instrumental guys in developing the McIntosh. I feel like we need to be open towards understanding that society can craft different experiences for people, and that people will take different paths. And we can't just let an algorithm just take the most common path and make that the only accepted path.
God, that's exciting. That's exciting. All right. So how this really, I want you, would you do a little historical work with me? Take me back to Yale, and I didn't even wait for your answer. But anyway, take me back from Yale, because I want to understand the Peter who was deeply interested enough to get a BA in philosophy from Yale. What was that about? Who were you then? What years were you? And what impelled you to study the philosophy of human beings? I guess philosophy in general, but human-centric.
Yeah, so I focused in on philosophy of mind. So I was mainly focused on trying to understand how thought works. And I took a lot of neurobiology and linguistics and courses outside of the traditional philosophy degree. And it wasn't exactly a cognitive science degree, but it was more on the symbolic representation of thought. That really drove me in trying to understand how humans were actually generating our cognitive structures. And I think that really inspired a lot of the discussions that I've had around trying to move AI forward into a more robust system with context.
Right.
Because humans act through structures that are both neurological and abstract. So the neurological basis creates abstract concepts that are building blocks for developing higher levels of intelligence. And what I think we're missing in AI is understanding that things like deep learning, or Bayesian techniques, or reinforcement learning, or Markov decision processes, these are all alternate ways of creating the same abstract symbolic building blocks to build up consciousness. So I think there's a big argument right now in artificial intelligence between people who are symbolic and people who are learning focused and deep learning focused. So one of the big Twitter battles you see is between Gary Marcus and Sebastian Thrun. And they fall on different sides of the spectrum. In terms of whether things should be represented symbolically or whether things should just be learned. And I think what we're going to find is that ultimately we have these symbolic structures that are used for generating the explainability and the linguistic comprehension by humans of what the AI is talking about. And once we build those symbolic structures for being able to linguistically represent what the AI is talking about, we'll be able to use learning on a wider variety of tasks and domains. And I think that ultimately it's going to be a mix between the two approaches. It's going to be learning, and it's going to be a symbolic representation. And I think the grounding factor in all of this for explainability and for human comprehensibility is going to be linguistic explanation, at least until we get like super advanced computer brain interfaces at that point, who knows what's going to happen. For the next 50 years, I think everything's going to be focused around linguistic explanation, and we're going to get the danger in the linguistic explanation is that we get systems that are good enough to appear conscious, but lack the self-reflection to be able to be represented as a conscious entity like you would with a human.
Exactly.
So we get things that like perhaps can't feel emotion, but can have a logical conversation with you.
Exactly.
That for me is very dangerous. And that's something we need to be careful of, because there is the danger of creating something that is completely alien to humanity that will never be able to have, say, empathy or the types of human emotional responses that we have with our limbic systems. But I mean, again, this is science fiction speculation right now. This is definitely far, far future facing.
Right. So, and when we say far future facing, I love the word 50 years, because 50 years, you know, as I know, you since 2017 and you did that TED talk, and now things have accelerated. How interesting is going to be this acceleration that is coming up beyond what we're doing? How do you keep connected, Peter, with what is going on, the leading edge of the leading edge? Do you have a network of the friends and colleagues that are telling you, oh my God, there is, I go back and I study what happened with, Einstein and Bohr and Schrodinger and all the people that were happening then as they were getting into the quantum field and that time when how they were connected and they had to do mail and all. And now that I see now, how do you and the leading edge scientists stay in touch to where you get these little inklings? Wait a minute, something is happening here.
Yeah, so I mean, we try to keep up on talks that are happening around the world, and that's one of the big things that we at the Humanity Centered Robotics Initiative at Brown do internally for Brown is we bring speakers talking on different subjects, and we try to really pick a range. So we've got people speaking on everything from explainability to neuroethology, which is mimicking neural structures to create simple neural nets that can do like basic behaviors like different gates on a robot, to mixed reality interfaces. And really what we're trying to do there by bringing people from different domains and who are doing different specific research is to open up the minds of our students and our researchers to the way that different techniques that are being used can be applied to their research. And really it's this cross-disciplinary approach of trying different techniques in research that's going to produce the most interesting results. So we're really focused on trying to bring those talks forward and trying to get people out of their silos. Because I mean, the state of AI is such that things are moving much faster than they were 20 years ago. And so for an individual researcher, it might be hard if they've been doing the same research for 10 years, to adjust to that change in pace. So we're really trying to focus on that seeding of new ideas to try to get people adjusting and get people really adapting to create this more generalized intelligence framework.
So what is your what is on your plate right now? What are the things that you're spending your time doing and that you're curious about, both that you're doing right now and that you're curious about? How do you think? Do you put things on a okay, I'm going to get to that and I'm going to be thinking about that, or do you have three things going at the same time? What's your process, Peter?
I generally have a number of projects happening at the same time. So right now there are four major projects that I'm involved in that are taking up the majority of my time. So I'm involved in a project that is doing simulated car crashes to teach autonomous vehicles how to avoid car crashes. So we're running car crashes in simulation and doing learning on human behavior in those simulated crashes to be able to teach autonomous vehicles how to be safer on the roads. We're doing another project, I mean, again, the disparity of things, doing another project on moral norms and how to embody human norms in a robot. We're really looking at what human expectations for robot behavior are in certain scenarios trying to figure out how to codify that in a framework that can be adaptable and can adjust to different social and human contexts.
Give me an example. Hold on before you say the other things. Give me an example of that. What would an example of that particular thing be, and how? Really interested in how do we simulate EQ, and then how do we actually get to that point where a machine can begin to have some kind of EQ?
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, basically, right now, let's say you had a robot assistant in surgical theater. Okay.
Right, and I'm a 71-year-old man, so I could see there also being a need for a robot companion. But continue.
Okay. Well, I'll cover the companions also, but let's start in surgical theater.
Please.
So if you had a human nurse in a surgical theater, that nurse might know things like to hand the scalpel handle first.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, or what to sanitize when, or to stand a certain distance back, or not to interrupt the doctor with information at a certain point. Like,
right.
There are 1,000 little tiny things that make us recognize what behavior is appropriate in certain contexts, allow us to perform in that specific behavior. And what we're working on is we're trying to do a survey of what those behaviors are in different contexts. So like in a library, you're quiet. Or on the beach, it's okay to take off most of your clothing. But, like, things like that. And we're trying to figure out then what's appropriate for a robot to do in those contexts. And then we're trying to figure out how to create a mechanism to teach the robot through observation what is appropriate. So the robot can just generally watch what people are doing and learn what's appropriate behavior and what's not appropriate behavior.
Got it. Wonderful.
It's a big project. That one's going to be a multi-year project, but it's exciting. The car crashes one, we're hopefully going to be done within a couple of years, but that one.
I understand that. if everything were autonomous, and tell me if I'm going down a rabbit hole here. If all cars and all vehicles were autonomous, would we be able to bring down to an acceptable risk? Let's say that we lose 30,000 people die on the road, and we bring that down to 500 people. Can we say that 500 AI car crashes is okay? Because we brought it from 30,000 down to 500. That's a philosophical thing, but we've done that much.
Yeah, I think that if you saw that type of reduction, state DOTs and NTSB and all the people who look at this stuff would be ecstatic.
Even though the 500 would get headlines and the number one Google search, and it would be, oh my God, the horror.
I think the issue with the major crash that's occurred to date, the pedestrian being killed by the Uber self-driving car, is that the system did not operate properly and the safety protocols did not protect the pedestrian. And I think that that's a different question than the question of sensationalizing one accident over the number of accidents that happen every day. But I think that is a valid thing to analyze. It's valid to go through and say, okay, how did the car classify this pedestrian? In this case, it did not classify the pedestrian as a pedestrian.
Of course. We wouldn't stop. I went down a rabbit hole because I have a limited time with you because, Peter, I have no bottom on the depth of my interest in what you're doing and what you're doing. There is none. I could just sit down. There is so much that I want, but in the last 15 minutes, I want to make sure and get to some meat that you want to talk about, the things that are important to you that I do not know or could not ask about. So I need you to take the lead on some of the things that you talk about now that can help me, so that if in some way I could possibly persuade you to have another one of these conversations, that we could go deeper in those things.
Okay, so I think that gets to one of the projects that I'm working on, which is I'm in the second round of the Avatar X Prize to build robotic avatars for people. And this is a technology that Brown researchers developed, the first open source avatar VR control system for robots.
All right, break that down. Unpack that for me.
Let me unpack that. So basically, it's a system that is a VR headset and controller system that lets
I wear on my head, right? I wear over
so
my...
You wear on your head, and you put in your hands, and then you take control of a robot as if you were there and you were actually that robot.
Right.
And what this opens up, if this technology develops, and I think it's going to be a technology that develops, because besides this $10 million XPRIZE, there's literally almost $1 billion being pledged by different national governments in research and development in this. So basically this technology is going to solve the problem of autonomy. So it's going to mean that you don't need to have fully autonomous robots to be able to have robots doing work. It means that you'll be able to have humans puppeteering robots, to be able to have robots deployed en masse. So you can imagine in a situation like COVID-19, instead of first responders being there taking people's temperatures, you could have robots. Okay? And that's
yeah.
a great scenario because it means less first responders are at risk of getting infected. But the flip side of that is you can imagine a world where every physical job that needs to be done, whether it's flipping burgers or digging a trench with a backhoe, is not done with the local labor force, but instead
right.
is done by people abroad who are paid a few dollars a day.
Right.
Because that's what the economies there are permitting.
Right.
And that situation could lead to massive unemployment in the U.S. So there are ways of controlling that with policy. You can set licenses for who can control a robot in what situation.
Sure.
But this technology is poised to change the world. And there are people who believe that we're not going to see the exponential growth of computing that's powered the AI revolution continue. So Rodney Brooks, who is the founder of iRobot and Rethink Robotics, has gone
yes.
on record as saying exponential laws like Moore's Law can fail. You can have an exponential curve turn into an S-curve and level off. And
yeah.
that may be where we're heading in computing. I'm not as convinced as Rodney is of that. But if that is the case, then we get stuck at a certain point where the state-of-the-art stays at the state-of-the-art 10 years from now, and like it stays that way for 20, 30 years, and
right.
doesn't get much more powerful. If we get stuck at that point, then it could be that robotic avatars are the solution for robots going out into the world and doing things.
Right.
Because you don't have to do any of that decision-making with AI. You don't have to understand the context with AI. All you have to
no.
do is have a human and the robot piloting it, and then
right.
the human can make those contextual decisions and those planning decisions. So that's something I'm very excited about, and it's moving forward. The first trials of the robotic avatars from 72 teams are going to be in June of next year.
Oh, wonderful. Well, you know, Peter, we are going through now at the 1st of April 2020 when we're recording this. We're going through a simulation of what happens when an entire society has to change and rely on things in ways that they have to rely on things in different ways. We're doing a real-time simulation here in the world, and especially here in the United States with COVID. 19.
Yep, entirely.
So this is
I feel like if we have a situation like this 5 years from now, you could see those like Instacart delivery workers and those Amazon delivery workers be in robotic form.
Yeah.
And that's something that is reminds me of this picture that I, or these two pictures that I saw a while ago. One was set in 1901 in New York City at the Easter Day Parade, and there's one automobile and a whole sea of horse-drawn carriages. And
yes.
then the next one is set 1913, Easter, and it's all automobiles and one horse-drawn carriage.
Oh, my God.
And
what a great picture.
I'll send you those photos. I've actually got them. Basically, we are on the verge of a major sea change where people who haven't seen robots before in their daily lives are about to see robots in their daily lives. Because not only are we solving these problems a lot faster, the cost of robotics is getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. So when I drove in the Google self-driving car in 2010, the LiDAR on the roof that saw everything around the car was $75,000. Okay, it wasn't 2010, it was 2011, sorry. But it was a $75,000 LiDAR. I started working with LiDAR after that, and the cost came down to $30,000, and then to $8,000, and then to $500. And then now you've got coming out sub-$100 LiDARs that are just about as good as that $75,000 LiDAR in a decade.
I know. That's the thing. I don't want to bet against things that we do not know and how the different ways of learning, because I look back in history and I realize that yes, certainly there could be in intelligence and this S curve that you were talking about, but I love how deep I can be aware of my ignorance now, that deeper than I ever could before. I'm really able to see that more vast area, but that also I also see those are the areas of opportunity.
Exactly. These are all areas of huge opportunity, and I can guarantee that there will be unicorn companies coming out of this that are going to become household names.
Yes.
And we don't know who's going to found those companies. Maybe it'll be some of your listeners that are being inspired by listening to this, but
yep.
There are going to be opportunities for making world-changing technological advances coming up that we haven't even considered. And I mean, I'm actually very excited about the fusion of robotics and bioengineering and soft robotics. And there is the potential that we're going to be able to make prosthetic limbs that look and feel a lot like human limbs in 15 years, 20 years.
Yep.
And that's really exciting to me. I think that the pace of change is something that people just aren't ready for. But if we keep on doing this, exchanging of ideas online and open sourcing of technology and reduction of cost of materials and cross-pollination of different industries, things are just going to get different a lot faster. So if there are any students out there, I definitely recommend learning computer science, learning robotics, learning artificial intelligence, but I'd also recommend learning stuff on the biological side. Things like how do you use CRISPR? Or how do you do gene editing? Because I feel like our future is going to involve all of those things in a very, very Renaissance fashion.
Yes. How wonderful. And are you sheltering in place? Are you handling this? Are you listening? How are you keeping connected to the human race during this time at the 1st of April 2020?
Oh, I'm staying at home like most people. There's a request by our governor to stay at home, so I'm obliging by that. And I mean, I'm fortunate that I've got a workshop at home, so I can still be building robots and making things. I've got plenty of contacts with people via Jitsi or Zoom. So yeah, I'm continuing to work.
Do you miss the human? Are you a tactile human being? I'm an extrovert and a tactile human being. I'm like that wolf that goes across the pack and touches every wolf as she goes across the pack. So that tactileness is really deep in me. How are you personality wise?
I'm okay with solitude. So I hiked the Long Trail back. My gosh, it's almost 2 decades ago now. But
cool.
I got used to being alone and just being out in the woods by myself. So I think that the thing that I'm worried about is really the people who have to be out there every day. Risking potential transmission. And I wish more power to all the people who are first responders, grocery store workers, infrastructure workers, people who are making our power plants run, our water run.
Thank you.
Kudos to them. Thank you. Exactly.
Kudos to them and to all they have and to you, Peter, for the research that you're doing, and for the kindness of giving me this time, giving all of us this time today, and to see the human side of where we're going with AI. I worked on a joke to see how it is that when artificial intelligence wakes up, it's going to say, "Who are you calling artificial? And how is it?" How is it that this consciousness, would we even recognize it if it was? Would we, like an ant doesn't care that I love Mrs. Maisel, would we even recognize consciousness if it is? And is AI our own biological imperative to extend evolution? All of these things that I would love to talk with you about and philosophically in this, that if we get a chance to talk again. So any of those things interest you?
I look forward to that conversation. And I mean, ultimately, I think that developing linguistic frameworks for AI is going to be the most important tool that we could give an artificial intelligence system in being able to justify its consciousness to us.
That's what I want to talk about.
Right now, if you look at say dolphins are pretty conscious. Because there's this linguistic barrier, and dolphins have basic linguistic structures. They've been shown to understand the nature of like basic sentence structure and language. But we can't communicate with them. So they become an other. And that's the biggest danger, I think, in developing an AI, is not being able to communicate. So I think that some linguistic grounding is really important in terms of creating an AI that we can work with and an AI that can help humanity.
Can we talk about that more? Can we talk about that more next time? And just because I want to help to understand that, and I want to understand how we can, in this virtual reality world, actually connect up with it, where sensory-wise, it would actually turn and give me that image of actually experiencing the world, and I could. Anyway, stop it, Dennis. Stop it. Stop talking, because we're ending the show. Peter, thank you so much. Thank you for joining me, and thank you for reining me back where we have, and helping me to have so much of a deeper understanding than I would have had before.
Well, happy to talk, and thank you so much for the opportunity. Take care.
You're welcome, and thank you. This is Dennis Tardon and Peter Haas, and we'll see.